ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। I'm going to read this morning Canto 3, Chapter 18. We'll start with text 6 and go for a few verses. This is Maitreya speaking to Vidura, and he's describing the interaction between Hiranyaksha and Lord Varaha. Hiranyaksha has just found out from Varuna, where he can find Hiranyaksha, and he confronts Hiranyaksha and speaks insulting words. Get ready for battle, you're finished. Kind of talk, chivalrous talk, insulting chivalrous talk. Text 6. Although the Lord was pained by the shaft-like abusive words of the demon, he bore the pain. But seeing that the earth on the ends of his tusks was frightened, he rose out of the water just as an elephant emerges with its female companion when assailed by an alligator. Report. The Mayavadi philosopher cannot understand that the Lord has feelings. The Lord is satisfied if someone offers him a nice prayer. And similarly, if someone decries his existence or calls him by ill names, God is dissatisfied. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is decried by the Mayavadi philosophers who are almost demons. They say that God has no head, no form, no existence, and no legs, hands, or other bodily limbs. In other words, they say that he's dead or lame. All these misconceptions of the Supreme Lord are a source of dissatisfaction to him, semicolon. He is never pleased with such atheistic descriptions. In this case, although the Lord felt sorrow from the piercing words of the demon, he delivered the earth for the satisfaction of the demigods who are ever his devotees. The conclusion is that God is sentient as we are. He is satisfied by our prayers and dissatisfied by our harsh words against him in order to give protection to his devotee. He is always ready to tolerate insulting words from atheists. Text 7. The demon, Hiranyaksha. The demon who had golden hair on his head and fearful tusks gave chase to the Lord while he was rising from the water, even as an alligator would chase an elephant. Roaring like thunder, he said, "Are you not ashamed of running away before a challenging adversary? There is nothing reproachable for shameless creatures." Report. When the Lord was coming out of the water, taking the earth in his arms to deliver it, the demon derided him with insulting words, but the Lord did not care because he was very conscious of his duty. For a dutiful man, there is nothing to fear. Similarly, those who are powerful have no fear of derision or unkind words from an enemy. The Lord had nothing to fear from anyone. Yet he was merciful to his enemy by neglecting him. Although apparently he fled from the challenge, it was just to protect the earth from calamity that he tolerated Hiranyaksha's deriding words. Text 8. The Lord placed the earth within his sight on the surface of the water and transferred to her his own energy in the form of the ability to float on the water. While the enemy stood looking on, Brahma, the creator of the universe, extolled the Lord, and the other demigods rained flowers on him. Purport. Those who are demons cannot understand how the Supreme Personality of Godhead floated the earth on water, but to devotees of the Lord, this is not a very wonderful act. Not only the earth, but many, many millions of planets are floating in the air. And this floating power is endowed upon them by the Lord. Semicolon. There is no other possible explanation. The materialist can explain that the planets are floating by the law of gravitation. But the law of gravitation works under the control and direction of the Supreme Lord. That is the version of Bhagavad Gita which confirms, by the Lord's statement, that behind the material laws, or nature's laws, and behind the growth, maintenance, production, and evolution of all the planetary systems, behind everything, is the Lord's direction. The Lord's activities could be appreciated only by the demigods headed by Brahma, and therefore, when they saw the uncommon prowess of the Lord in keeping the earth on the surface of the water, they showered flowers on him in appreciation of his transcendental activity. So, stop there. Just like in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna concludes chapter 9, saying, Manmana bhava madbhakto madhyajimam namaskaru. Then he proceeds, having explained in chapter 9 the very special position of bhakti, and he explains ananya bhakti as opposed to mixed bhakti and advocates ananya bhakti and then indicates one should always think of him in this undivided devotion mood. So to explain further about that undivided devotion or ananya bhakti, Krishna begins describing himself in his fullness, and part of his fullness is his opulences, but first of all, he's the source of everything, opulence or whatever else exists. Arjuna hears Krishna's words and says, oh my God, you're the source of everything. Can you describe your opulences? Can you give me ways in which I can always think of you? Because Manmana was already directed or instructed. So the opulences of the Personality of Godhead are ways by which these opulences, meaning the worldly manifestations that are particularly opulent, these are ways that can help us always think of Krishna. And so, in the Bhagavatam, we're being given exhibitions of the Lord's opulences, a number of them, floating the earth on the water, and rescuing the earth from the bottom of the Garbhadak ocean. And then there's going to be other opulences, the opulences of battle with an extremely powerful living entity, but easily defeating him. And above all, most important of all, is his personal nature. So that's the first of these verses that we discussed. It's not wrong, nor is it, should it be surprising, that the Supreme Lord has feelings. And as a person has feelings. However, his feelings shouldn't be considered to be like our feelings. It's the other way around. Our feelings are perverted reflections of his feelings. Like this, this example of, feeling saddened by the harsh words of Hiranyaksha. The Lord was pained by the shaft-like abusive words of the demon. He bore the pain. So, if someone decries his existence or calls him by ill names, God is dissatisfied. All these misconceptions of the Supreme Lord are a source of dissatisfaction to him. He is never pleased by such atheistic descriptions. The Lord felt sorrow from the piercing words of the demon. No, it's not sorrow like we know, or dissatisfaction like we know, or it's not a feeling like we know. Because the feelings, like we know, are not transcendental. They're based upon what all living entities in the material world want. And when they don't get what they want, they feel something. Frustration, anger, sorrow, disappointment, sadness. The modes of nature, the lower modes of nature. So, his feelings are without the modes of nature. And it's an exhibition of his ecstasy. That sounds like a contradiction, but it's not. The science of rasa is that raso vai saha, this is a Vedic Shruti statement, or Vedanta Sutra statement, that the absolute truth, Saha, is rasa. And the science of rasa teaches us that there's primary, there's secondary rasas, and the secondary rasas enhance the primary rasa for the living entities, but the Supreme Lord is the source of all rasas, so he includes everything. Otherwise, how can the living entity feel feelings? It has to be there in the source of everything, otherwise we can't have even a portion or even a distorted reflection of anything. It has to be in the supreme imperfection. So when he's feeling sorrow or dissatisfied or disturbed or whatever feeling about, it's an ecstasy. And his not bearing the pain, because this is the Bhagavatam, it's telling us his feelings. It's not like, you know, we tolerate some insult. That's what we're supposed to do. Titiksha. You tolerate duality. For him, for the Supreme Lord Vishnu, there's no duality. He doesn't have to tolerate duality. But it's his tolerance, bearing the pain of insult, is a transcendental feeling. It's important to going through this slowly and kind of repeatedly, because the material conception of God yesterday evening was conceptions of divinity. So we know from Bhagavad Gita, the conception of divinity from the materialistic point of view is he's like us. Maybe, you know, a better version of us, but he's like us. He has a material body that is born and it expires, and then he's just a better version, and I can become a better version than him, or at least equal, and so forth. Or it doesn't exist at all. There's no such thing as God. God meaning the source of everything. In that sense, the Almighty, All-Powerful, no such thing. Those conceptions are spoon-fed by material association, certainly in this lifetime and in previous lifetimes. It's just the nature of the place where we are. And it's increasing and increasing and increasing as Kaliyuga advances and advances. The movements of the lower modes of nature is increasing. Passion and ignorance increasing rapidly, rampantly, with sense gratification and its dissatisfaction and violence, and so it's Kali Yuga. So this isn't Kali Yuga, but the principle is there's pure everything exists in the Supreme in its pure state. So when we hear he's feeling pain, don't think of it like ours. Someone insults you and you feel something. Not that. It's an ecstasy. And it's part of, we just go back to Jai and Vijay being cursed to become demons. Prior to their being cursed to become demons, we discussed this somewhere along the line. They, as gatekeepers of Narayana, being intimately in his service, they could understand his mood, and his mood is, there's this chivalrous rasa that's in him, because everything is in him. And he wants some combat, but who can be a suited combatant for Narayana? So, in their minds, they both prayed, if you so desire, we can do that service. And so he made an arrangement so they could do that service. So it's an ecstasy back to Narayana and Vaikuntha. It's an ecstasy for Narayana and Vaikuntha, but there's no demons in Vaikuntha. So the devotees, Jai and Vijay, came here. The Lord descended and did combat. And the combatant says harsh things, and the Lord feels things, and it's just part of rasa. We shouldn't be disturbed. He's not disturbed. In the worldly sense of disturbance, he feels as he feels when something, some words of prayer or praise or an offering is made, he accepts. He accepts with happiness. And the other is, he's dissatisfied. And his energies and his potencies and his opulences act accordingly. He can withdraw the opulences from such persons. In this case, he's gonna finish him. Back to this neutral state, no more opulences. In Hiranyaksha's hand because of his offense. That's just a law of nature. Nature is under his control. He's in this field of material nature. So he's doing, as Prabhupada says, when Lord Varaha first appears, it's appropriate for time, place, and circumstance. He fell at the bottom of the earth fell at the bottom of the Garbhadak Ocean. And the Garbhadak Ocean is below the lower planetary systems of the universe. So it's although at the Garbhodak ocean at the bottom, it's not a fit place for something that's pure, so he comes to rescue. Then we hear, as he's tolerating and doing his, quote, duty, he has no duty, but he has affection for the demigods. And because the demigods have requested, he's reciprocating with the request of the demigods. Looks like he's, henpecked. Or, controlled by those who are his servants. They say he does. But it's not like that. In other words, for us, same principle. For us, there's duty. For the Supreme Lord, he has no duty. He says in Bhagavad Gita. And yet he does things. He does things seemingly as if it's a duty. But it's seemingly as if it's a duty. It's not like our sense of duty. So, it's loving reciprocation with the demigods. And what are the demigods doing? They're just doing loving reciprocation with the Lord. He wants, they do. And they want, he does. And it's all for this ultimate higher purpose of the interest of the Supreme Lord. Like, why is creation existing in the first place? Why? Why creation? And we discussed that yesterday. Compassion. The living entity should experience the fullness of their happiness. That potential should be there. He wants. So the material world is that opportunity. Of course, too many don't fulfill that purpose. They do something else. They do the sense gratification program. So, he is rescuing the earth by his opulence of mystic power. He flows the earth. This nice discussion, the demigods understand. The demon doesn't understand. They think, Hiranyaksha thinks, you have mystic power, but, you're a coward. You can float the earth, big deal. I can do mystical things too, and you're gonna get yours. You're worshipped by the demigods, but you're not even functioning according to the codes of chivalry. I've challenged you, and you're fleeing from the battlefield. You coward. So, demons, whether they're dealing with the Lord or they're dealing with those in connection with the Lord or even dealing with each other, they're, harsh. The modes of nature are what they are. When someone flatters them, they can speak nicely, and someone doesn't flatter them, they can do anything. Because they're demons. It's just the nature of demoniac mentality. So, as we're hearing in Bhagavad Gita, the Bhagavatam is giving us a panorama of the teachings of Bhagavad Gita. So that's what it looks like. It's not all the same, but in principle, that's what it looks like. The divine and demoniac nature. Are you not ashamed of running away before a challenging adversary? There is nothing reproachable for shameless creatures. So he, Lord Varaha, tolerated and continued with his activity and floated the earth so that it wouldn't be submerged in the Garbhodak ocean. Later he's going to put it back in its orbit, but Prabhupada's explanation is what's wonderful about this? As planets are floating in air, why a planet can't float in water? Because the scientists have their explanation. They call it gravitation. He doesn't get into it, but I'll just speak a couple of things. This law of gravitation is the principle that as far as I understand it, there may be a new version, but the one that I had learned was planets are held in orbit because of gravitation. This mass and that mass, and it's a gravitational field, and that's what holds planets in orbit. However, there's a problem. And the problem is there's something like 40% or something, maybe a bigger number, of the mass of the universe is just missing. They can't find it. You know, the theory of gravitation sinks. It's a nice theory. So then, okay, well, you can't find all the mass because there's black holes, and mass falls into black holes, and you can't see it, but it's there. Wow. Gravitation doesn't, it's a nice theory, but it doesn't do the job. So Prabhupada doesn't get into that. He just says, so if there's gravitation, there's that law of nature, what makes the law and what supports and maintains the law? Who makes the law and who, the laws of nature, who creates nature, who creates the law, who maintains the law? So however you want to look at it, behind everything, there's the Supreme. It's sensible, and the other isn't. It's within our experience that behind something there's a person. But then the atheist says, no, there's no person behind everything. So where's your experience? What leads you to make this inference? It doesn't match logic. Where in the experience of anything does something come from nothing? Or whatever are the other explanations. It's a theoretical explanation. Purposefully to dismiss God, it's demoniac. And Prabhupada is being a little soft here by saying Mayavadis are almost atheistic. They're atheistic. Mayavad philosophers who are almost demons. The personality of Godhead is decried by the Mayavadi philosophers who are almost demons. Well, they're almost demons. It's pretty soft, but God is dead. Or there is no God. And just, you know, by word jugglery, put God out of existence. Or by so-called science, God doesn't exist. So there. And, you know, prove me wrong. Well, what about the other way around? God exists, prove me wrong. So you accept the authority of some scientist. We accept the authority of the Vedas. You don't accept our authority. We don't accept your authority. Let's talk common sense. Then the scientists keep referring to their authority. Although they refuse to accept our, we don't have to accept their authority. It's just, it's an important point when you're discussing with somebody that's doubtful, if not a full-on atheist. This is what Prabhupada did with Professor Katosky, and he referred to it many, many, many times. What's the difference between you and me, Professor Katosky? You accept some authority. Lenin. I accept some authority. Krishna. What's the difference between us? Can you live without accepting some authority? What is the difference? You accept some authority, I accept. What is the difference? Now, we can look at, should we accept Lenin or Krishna? But going down from that, you have to accept some authority. So the scientist accepts predecessor scientists, but they're also very busy in debunking what a previous scientist said, because that makes their livelihood, that, you know, that was wrong, here's the reason why, falsifiability, and here's a better answer. Now I have a, you know, a degree, or whatever it is, some renown in the world of academia because I debunked the previous guy and presented another one. Then somebody comes along and says, no, it's not like that because, and here's another one. And so it goes. But the knowledge of the Vedas doesn't come and go like that. One may not understand. One may not be able to verify, but the knowledge doesn't change over time or some luminary of a brilliant person, because the source is a perfect source. It's not time-bound. It's eternal knowledge. So, Bhagavatam is presenting this nice description of Lord Varaha and his interaction with Hiranyaksha. See if there's any discussion. Yes. Simple. The Garbhadak ocean is within each universe. And the causal ocean is not, and the universes are floating on the causal ocean.
It's just like the ocean that they see?
No. That's a saltwater ocean. That's on the Earth planet. The Earth planet has its ocean. I don't understand your question. I don't understand why you're asking the question.
I'm trying to visualize the picture.
Well, the picture of what Lord Varaha did was he lifted the earth from the bottom of the Garbhadak ocean to float on the Garbhadak ocean. And later we'll place it back in its orbit, you know, in the 14th planetary system. So the Earth has its landmass and its oceans. Now, I don't have an answer to what happened to the oceans when it got submerged, oceans of Earth when it got submerged in the Garbhadak Ocean. There's no explanation. So I can't answer that, if that's what you're asking. But the relationship is, there's a smaller ocean, the oceans of Earth, we know its makeup. The Garbhadak ocean is the perspiration from the body of Garbhadaksha and Vishnu. And the causal ocean is the causal ocean. It's not generated and then disappears. It's eternally existing.
Is that the milk ocean?
No. The milk ocean is the ocean of Paramatma or Shiradakshayi Vishnu. That's different.
Another question.
Okay.
Yesterday in the conception of divinity class, you were explaining about Devidham, Mahidham and Haridham.
Yeah.
So, is it correct that Devidham includes all the universes that are floating on the causal ocean?
That's all part of Devidham, yes.
There's only one Devi who oversees all these. I mean,
why not? Like, she can have her expansions, but it's one Devi.
It's not like, the reason I ask is because for each universe we have a different Brahma who created. So, for each universe, is there a different Devi and a different...
Well, the Devi is not Jiva. Devi is Shakti Tattva.
And similarly, is there different Lord Shiva for each?
He's in his own Shiva Tattva. He may manifest himself very, just like right after, in this universe, we hear in the Bhagavatam, Brahma's first born living entities or sons were the Kumaras when they declined to assist him in the Prajapati program. From his brow came Lord Shiva and immediately Lord Shiva expanded into 11 Rudras. They're his expansions. So he can expand. So it's Lord Shiva's expansions and Shiva Tattva is one entity who has expanded himself per universe, yes.
Thank you.
But it's different than living entity. Lord Brahma is a Jiva.
We have our duty.
Duty.
Yes. And so even as we do our duty in service to their Lordship, whether it is for the deity or the temple, and if you see demoniac mentality, you shouldn't feel hurt. We are ordinary living entities. Of course, our feelings are different, but our service is for the Lord.
Yeah. So we do what Krishna says to do. That's what we do. We don't make those feelings zero, but at least, chapter 2 Bhagavad Gita, we tolerate those feelings. Now, we may act in service to Krishna for his pleasure, depending upon the circumstance, but not arising from retaliation if we're feeling some feeling or yet, it's not with us at the center, it's with Krishna at the center. So we may act upon those feelings, even in the space of tolerating them. We may do something that's appropriate for the circumstance. Let's say, if someone blasphemes a devotee, we may take some action. We may leave the place. We may defeat the person. We may do different things according to the indication of scripture. We don't make the feeling zero. That's impersonal. Depends on the circumstance, what's appropriate. Yes.
Thank you so much. I have two questions, Maharaj. The first one is maybe slightly related to Premananda Mahatma's question. From today's discussion, you mentioned that Lord Varaha tolerated the insults of Hiranyaksha for a higher purpose, which is to protect the earth. So similarly, when we face insults from people, I'm just trying to understand what is the higher purpose that I need to have apart with the process of continuing to tolerate.
Continuing to tolerate? Well, continuing to tolerate is over there. And this, what is appropriate, same as the answer to Premananda. What is appropriate behavior given the circumstance depends on the circumstance. And the purpose of the behavior is to please Krishna. Whatever that is. And if you don't know what it is, then you continue just to tolerate till it becomes clear what the proper behavior is. Next question.
And you mentioned a very interesting point that every feeling comes from Krishna, even the feeling of pain, sorrow, and today's class.
That's not exactly what I said. I said, within Krishna, everything exists in its pure state.
Yes, sir.
So we have feelings because we're part and parcel of Krishna. It's natural. We're persons as he is a supreme person. It's not that our feelings are his feelings. That's what you said. Well, that's what you said. Because of his feelings, we have feelings. No. We're part of him, part and parcel of him, so we're also persons. And as he has everything, we have a small amount, and it's distorted, centered on selfishness and sense gratification, how I can be the enjoyer. That's where our feelings arise from.
The reason I asked that question is, Maharaj, because before this class, I was of the understanding that as one progresses in devotional service, the feelings of sadness, pain, they subside. But today's class was kind of a reminder, or it made it clear that these feelings can still exist, but the platform changes from material to transcendental. So my question...
Our sadness, etc., is grounded, ours is grounded in selfishness. And, frustrated sense gratification. I want to be the enjoyer property and it's not working out. I have my expectations of enjoyment and it's not working out. Somebody's interfering. Or something is interfering, and I feel something. Now, go ahead. I'm just editing the frame of your question.
So, I just wanted to have your thoughts or make it clarify if, as one advances in the stage of bhakti, these feelings can still continue to exist, but the platform can, it slowly changes from, or lessens from materialistic.
A real nice, something that will help you understand your question, or the answer to your question, is in Queen Kunti's prayer to Krishna to please take away, the affection for the Pandavas and the Rishis. Prabhupada says, affection is natural. You can't be alive and not have affection. That's impersonal, he says. So there's affection. So there's a feeling. And then you expand the principle. But it's not that we want to not have affection. It's the repose or the objective, he uses that word, the objective of that affection. Where does it go? Where do you take that affection? Repose it. Krishna should be pleased. Minus Krishna should be pleased, you have material existence. Affection rooted in material existence. Just because of ignoring Krishna. And Krishna consciousness means you purify that affection and any other feeling by directing it that Krishna should be pleased to whatever that is. Somebody insults you. There's a feeling. What do you do with that feeling? My dear Lord Krishna, I'm a selfish person and I'm thinking, me, myself, and I. I'm a narcissist. I'm thinking about me and not thinking about you. Please remove that which blocks you and let my feelings be flow to you. It's a whole other, way of dealing with feelings of whatever they may be. Okay. Anyone else?
No, this is different another devotee's question who's attending live. We are told to have some faith in the scriptures and accept the authorities, but at the same time, it should not be blind faith. Could you please share some light on this? I feel, in a way, faith of both the scientists and devotees is blind. That's my question.
Both the devotees and the scientists are blind.
Faith of faith of the devotees and the scientists.
Well, what's the difference between blind faith and any other kind of faith? And you let's just use the word principle-based or reason-based. Reason doesn't prove anything. But reason-based is not blind. I don't just accept. I give careful thought, just like we've been speaking. Behind everything, there's nothing. Or behind everything, there's a person. Which is reasonable. For example. And if behind everything, there's a person, then what must be the characteristics of that person? And you know, Ajita, Achyuta, he cannot fall. He's infallible. He has all potency. He's not limited. We're limited. So it follows logically. Now scripture says, but it makes sense. Not blind faith. There's the faith that because it says it in scripture, we accept it because the source is infallible source. But it's sensible. As opposed to accepting the faith of a scientist who's fallible. Who derives his knowledge, just like, you know, the three primary means of knowing something, pramana, sense, reason, and authority. Accepting authority is more reasonable than accepting a statement from someone who's basing things on sense, perception, or reason. It's not blind faith. It's sensible. And so forth. So one should consider very carefully. Prabhupada doesn't say, he said, just accept. Consider very carefully, try to understand. And that nourishes faith. And then another is you act, and that's very important, you act in knowledge and there's realization. Now scientists can say, exactly, that's our program. We act in knowledge and we get, you know, we have technology, and we learn certain things, we do certain things with technology, and we get a result that gives us faith in science and technology. It's not to say one who knows the push and pull of the laws of nature doesn't know the push and pulls of the laws of nature and can get results by the push and pull, the cause and effect of the laws of nature. So this is something different. Where do the laws of nature come from? Where does Prakriti come from? What's governing it? You're, that's the question. Your thing is, there's nothing behind it. Just the laws of nature, period. That's quite unreasonable.